I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. We're going to do something a little different this week. On Sunday morning, once again, a man with a gun brought unfathomable grief into a community when he walked into First Baptist Church in tiny Sutherland Springs, Texas, and started shooting everyone in sight, including babies. We're not going to say his name, but he fits the pattern of other armed killers to a T. White, male, kicked out of the military, with a history of domestic violence.
In addition to the deep pain and rage that we feel, this latest shooting got us thinking about how deeply ingrained gun culture is in some conservative evangelical communities, and about the role fear plays in modern evangelicalism, and the ways some white evangelicals have reverse-engineered theological justifications for gun worship.
So, Nish, one of the things I thought of when we discussed having this as our sole topic today is a trip that I took almost exactly 2 years ago to a Bible college out in the middle of North Dakota. And when I mean the middle of North Dakota, I mean I think I passed through one stoplight between Fargo and where I was going. I had gone out there on assignment because I had watched a documentary we're going to get into a little bit later called The Armor of Light that makes kind of an argument for evangelicals and other folks who consider themselves pro-life to incorporate opposition to guns and at least the proliferation of guns into their pro-life worldviews. And an editor of mine who was thinking the right way on this did not share my enthusiasm for the movie. He said, well, you know, is this actually going to work? I think in order to write about it, you need to go watch the screening of the film with some conservative evangelicals and get a sense of, you know, whether they find it persuasive or not. You know, I reluctantly agreed that my editor was right and booked a ticket to Fargo and drove out to this Bible college and thought, you know, I grew up in evangelical circles. I consider myself evangelical now. I've been reporting on religion and politics for 15 years. Like, I can do this. I know what I'm doing. I'm totally comfortable here. And I have to say, it was really an eye-opening but really personally disturbing experience because what it revealed to me was something that I had just completely missed that's been happening in evangelical culture over the last at least decade or so, which is this strong, strong, strong strain of fear that I think comes from a few different places, but especially from the way Fox News has had just as much of an impact, if not more, than churches and preaching has in forming people's faith. And so kind of the upshot of it was we all watched this movie. And then they let me come up with them because there was going to be a discussion period for an hour, hour and a half afterwards, and just kind of listen in. And what I heard was basically, with one or two exceptions, a room full of these Bible school students who just did not buy it, who believed that it was not just okay to arm themselves and be very prepared to take another life, but that it was almost their responsibility as Christians. They were citing, and I know you're going to walk us through this in a little bit, but they were citing biblical justifications that they saw requiring them to use any means necessary to protect themselves and their loved ones. And what really threw me for a loop, though, is what it was that these students had as an attachment to guns. You know, it's a very rural area. I assumed there would be a lot of hunters and it would be kind of a culture of, I grew up with guns. I grew up hunting with my grandfather. You know, I don't want somebody taking my guns. But it was much more of a defensive posture of feeling like they had to have guns to protect themselves from threats. And that is what I had missed, was this sense, because these were not hypotheticals people were talking about. They were talking about the reality, as if it will be something that they'll confront. Somebody will break into their house and they will need to protect themselves. What really just threw me was one kid saying, you know, we've got to have guns because, you know, if I run into somebody from ISIS, like, I want to be able to take that guy down. And I'm thinking, ISIS, like, dude, again, I didn't pass through a single, like, town on my way here. You're in the middle of nowhere. And when I got home, I looked up the statistics, and this was in, let's see, 2015. In the previous year, there had been 10 homicides by gun in the entire state of North Dakota. So 10. And I want to say like 7 of the 10 were friends or family, because that's usually how most violence is committed. It's you know, a confrontation with somebody you actually know. There is virtually zero stranger violence or threat in this community where you would need to use a gun to protect yourself. And yet it was, again, not just like something they thought could happen, and so you want to have like a bit of safety insurance, but no, like, this was going to happen. They felt it in their bones and they needed to be ready for it. And that kind of started me on this 2-year journey of really thinking through the power of fear and how that itself has shaped evangelicalism, not the other way around. Not that there's something about evangelicalism that has drawn people to guns, although I think we'll talk about how it maybe poses some obstacles in terms of being willing to consider ways to address gun violence and deal with that. But how this was just a version of evangelicalism that I did not recognize. And in fact, I came back and I wasn't able to write about it. Because I just needed time to grapple with it and understand it. And because it was also so personally upsetting to me to, you know, understand what had happened to a religious tradition I grew up in and that I still considered myself part of.
The fear is what gets me. The fear is the thing that when I think about even our theology and how our understanding of God frames some of these political issues, the thing that is so, I mean, frustrating is definitely one word to say it, but fascinating to me is the ease in which particularly conservative evangelicals slip into this mentality of fear. That, you know, this outside world is out to get us. And it's not even that like the outside world is dangerous. It's that the outside world is on the offense against Christianity and is out to destroy us. Like, it is that, it is fascinating to me. Because I just, again, maybe I just don't see it because I'm not indoctrinated into that 24 hours of Fox News cycle either. And so.
But it's the language. It's the war on Christmas, which we laugh about. But yep. That's real, like, language of threat. They talk about religious persecution all the time. And it doesn't matter if it's in the context of, you know, the Little Sisters of the Poor not wanting to provide contraception coverage, or if it's actually, you know, Christians being killed in the Middle East. Like, you know, it's all covered with the same volume up to 11. This is a threat and you are being persecuted and your lives are at stake.
I'm just like speechless. I know I'm like usually full of words, but I'm like,
while you're speechless, I just want to make sure, just so listeners know, we're not beating up on white evangelicals here. You know, the polling is pretty clear. When pollsters ask both about attitudes about gun control, gun ownership, but then stricter gun laws. There's been a bunch of research done, particularly by the Public Religion Research Institute. And they did a poll in 2013, after there had been a bunch of shootings. This was not long after the Aurora shooting. And every single religious group, large majorities of them, support stricter gun laws. The only exception are white evangelicals. And so just to give you some numbers here, 76% of Black Protestants support stricter gun control laws, 67% of Catholics, white mainline Protestants even, which are usually a little closer aligned to white evangelicals, 57%. But among white evangelicals, only 35% of them supported stricter gun control laws.
And this is the thing that is really frustrating to me, because I feel like so much of the narrative of the debate, particularly within white conservative evangelical gun culture, has been around this idea that gun control equals the government is going to come and take all of your guns away. Like that is what's being equated. And that's 100% wholly false. Like that is completely and totally false. The reality or the possibility even that we will get rid of guns in this culture is, to say it's a moonshot is being incredibly generous. And like it's not going to happen. And we'll talk about that a little bit later about why, you know, it's too hard to uproot all of the guns out of America. But all that to say, there's this mentality that to instill stricter gun laws means the government is out to get you. Like, where is that coming from? Where is that coming from? And it's coming from a complete false framing of the narrative by, I mean, in my opinion, from what I've seen, entirely conservative media. Would you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've got a combination of the NRA, which for financial reasons wants to push that narrative. You've got Republicans who benefit politically from pushing that narrative and, you know, warning that, you know, liberals want to come and take your guns, to which I always say, well, then Barack Obama has to be the most inept politician in the world, because he had 8 years and he didn't take
anybody's
any
guns
of your guns away. And the fact that people still fall for that after what I see is irrefutable evidence that Democrats are not actually conspiring to take away your guns when they had the majorities and the White House, they didn't do a thing about that. It just kind of boggles my mind. But then you also have the third piece of this, which is some religious leaders who not only support but really push unfettered access to guns. We're not talking gun ownership. We're talking unfettered access. And, you know, as an example, our old friend Robert Jeffress was interviewed yesterday. And, you know, it is a tricky question for a lot of houses of worship, how to provide security, but also be an open and welcome space where everyone can worship. You know, most synagogues and mosques in this country have to have security guards and metal detectors to keep them safe. Churches have been lucky not to go that far. But Jeffress was suggesting that the way to deal with this is just to have all the congregants be armed. He talked about the fact that a third to half of his congregation are concealed carry folks, and that they bring guns with them to church, and that that makes him feel safer. I mean, I will just lay my cards on the table here, because I know a lot of people have nostalgic attachments to hunting and family traditions with that. I hate guns. They terrify me. I don't think we need them anymore. If it was up to me, they would just all be gone. But, you know, you can save your hate mail. No need to hit return there, because I'm not in a position to do that. I can't make it happen. But I just think there are a lot of things that we used to do and consider fun, clean, enjoyment that we don't anymore. And I just wish that it wasn't a thing. But this goes beyond just being a cultural form of recreation to something that, you're right, is a kind of ideological, anti-government, anti-communitarian stand too, because it's everyone for themselves.
It is everyone for themselves.
Just to take this one step further, I mean, you talked about how it becomes this warped version of evangelicalism that we don't remember or recognize. You know, when I think of fear and the Bible, what I think of are the dozens of verses that tell us to be not afraid, trust in the Lord your
God.
That's
right. That's exactly right.
And I want to know what Bibles we're reading that I look through it and I see promises that God will be there for me. It doesn't mean nothing bad will ever happen to me, but that my foremost orientation needs to be to trust in Him, not in myself, and not to think that I alone or I and my sidearm alone is what will protect me from evil.
Well, that's right. And this is going to go into my point that I want to make, which is more of, you know, my theory on evangelical theology and the tie to guns. In my view, and this is just, you know, this is my opinion, my observation, that there is an inherent tie between the fierce independence and fierce individualism in evangelical theology and the tie to want to own guns, to quote unquote protect myself, and this idea of personal security. It is pretty clear, if you know anything about evangelical theology, there is a view on salvation that essentially says what I understand as the gospel is Jesus came to die for my sins, personal, me, singular, so that I, personal, singular, can then go to heaven, so that I will be saved. So it really is this emphasis on personal, independent salvation. Now, I'm not saying that's false. That's true. Those things are true theologically. As a Christian, I believe that that's true. But in my view, outside of that kind of individualist perspective, is that that's only just a part of it. That's only a part of what we would understand as the gospel and the wholeness of why Jesus came. And so looking at that fierce individualism, that fierce independence, if my understanding between myself and God, myself and Jesus, and what that reconciliation looks like is only independent and is not in any way, shape, or form communal, or has any sort of what we would call a kingdom ethic, that Jesus came for my sins, yes, but he also, you know, came for the redemption of the world, and that we would say the kingdom of God is at hand. If I lack that communal peace, if I lack that kingdom peace, it's going to narrow my scope of things that I can control or things that I need to take part of, as it's going to narrow all of those policy debates to be very independent. And so my safety and my security, or the security of my family, the safety of my family, will inherently trump. Oh gosh, sorry, I can't even say that word anymore.
I need a new word.
Yes, it will inherently take precedence over the goodwill and the flourishing of my neighbor. And so there's this mentality of my security, my safety is my responsibility, rather than we all need to be looking out for the well-being of each other and the well-being of our communities, and, you know, blow that up even more, the well-being of our cities, our states, and our nation. And so there's this really inherent tie between the independent and individualist theology and this desire for security and this fear of an outside threat. Because if everything is dependent on me and everything is about me, that's where that responsibility is going to lie. And so how does that play out within, you know, American culture where guns are, there are, you know, more guns than there are people. And that's what makes this kind of an inherently American problem, right? Is that, you know, we want to say, oh, it's mental health. Oh, it's crime. Oh, it's, you know, whatever, whatever. But the statistics time and time and time again, there was a piece that just came out again this morning in the New York Times that showed again that the more guns that are available, the more mass shootings there are and the more gun violence there is. And so it's just, it's all these things tied together.
And even setting aside mass shootings, you know, domestic violence, killings of female partners, you know, we just know are going to happen when there are guns in the house. And so that just picking up your discussion of individualism, like that becomes a trade-off that people are willing to make when it's all about protecting their family at all costs. It's, I am willing to accept deaths that we know will happen when there are more guns in society for the small, small chance that I will one day be in a position where the only thing standing between my family being killed and not is me with a gun. And, you know, the sense of whether that's a small or a big chance, I think, gets warped by conservative political rhetoric and intentionally warped by Fox News, which relies on people being in a state of fear and needing to turn to Fox News. But there's another aspect of this individualism that bothers me, and that is, you know, we hear so often after one of these shootings when it's a white man, and so we don't jump to conclusions about connections. There's always an assumption if the attacker is a person of color that this is part of a system. Either if they're Black or Hispanic, it's part of a gang or criminal related system. If they're Muslim, then it's obviously part of radical Islamic terror. But when it's a white man, it's an evil person. And evil can't be explained. And it's an individual person. It's certainly not linked to toxic masculinity and any responsibility the church might have for pushing that and not presenting men with other ways to deal with difficulties in their relationships. It's certainly not related to nationalism and our refusal to talk about what happens to the soldiers that we send to war and the PTSD they come back with. There was a long thread on Twitter today from a vet who said, look, like I spent 6 years. I was trained to be an Army infantryman. I loved my time in the military. I love my fellow vets, but let's not mince words. We were trained to be killers. And there's no doubt in my mind that if I had to, I could kill people, you know, tactically without even a moment's hesitation today. And that does something to people. And then when you put military grade weapons in their hands and you give them some sort of trigger, and you know, not a literal trigger, but an emotional or mental trigger that sets them off, you know, you can't ask, well, why? How did this happen? You know why it happened. But by focusing solely on an individual and what their, you know, soul and, you know, what evil influence there might have been on them, it kind of gets you a free pass from having to consider anything that might have been connected or, you know, point to ways to minimize it. Nobody's saying we're going to eliminate gun violence in the country, but we do for sure know ways that we can make these kinds of shootings less likely and domestic violence murders less likely.
That's right. And I hear this argument all the time about it's not a gun issue, it's a heart issue. or it's not a gun issue, it's a sin issue. And we need to talk about the fact that perhaps toxic masculinity is a sin, that the way we treat women and talk about women is a systemic sin. The way we talk about and oppress minorities is a sin. The way, like, there are all
loving
of,
guns more than we love our neighbors.
The idolization of tools of death is a sin. When are we going to start evaluating these sort of systemic issues that are perpetuating a problem that is killing people on a massive scale, and it's happening more and more? And ultimately, this is the one of the lines that came out of this New York Times piece today, and I think it goes right along with what we're saying about evangelicals as well. Said, after Britain had a mass shooting in 1987, the country instituted strict gun control laws. So did Australia after a 1996 incident. Both of those were somewhat equivalent to like a Sandy Hook shooting. So, you know, massive loss of life and children. But the United States has repeatedly faced the same calculus and determined that relatively unregulated gun ownership is worth the cost to society. And that is ultimately the issue. That's the hard issue that I want to talk about. It's not about individual sin and the evil that's going on in one person. It's the evil and unrepentant sin that's going on throughout our entire culture that wants to put independent rights to own a gun over the well-being of our neighbors. And it makes me fired up, Amy. It gets me so angry. And I'm saying this just to lay my own cards on the table as a gun owner. We have guns in our family that have been passed down from generation to generation on my husband's side of the family. They're heirloom rifles, hunting rifles, some used in like World War II. It has been a part of my husband's family culture for a long time. And there is a way to preserve some of those traditions, the ability for people to provide food for their families, because that does happen in some areas of the country. But I think of places like Alaska, you know, where people go and shoot a moose and that's their meat for the entire winter. Like, I have a family friend who that's what they do. And so there are ways like what they did in England.
But can we agree you don't need a semi-automatic rifle to kill a moose?
You do not need an AR. No, you do not need an AR-15, nor do you need a handgun. You don't need that. You don't need high capacity magazines. You don't need, like, there's so many things that we go, we can preserve people's right to provide food and sustenance for their families, where people can protect their livestock against, you know, animal threats. Like, that's the other thing that happens. Like, there are things that other countries have done that allow people with really strict regulations to own guns for the right purposes. But at what point do we say no more? Like, this is a sickness. It is an internal sickness in this country that at the very bottom line, we are unwilling to self-evaluate because we don't think it's worth the cost. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. And until we start doing that internal soul searching, we're going to come up with, I mean, it's just going to be the same response every single time this happens. And mark my words, it'll happen again, because this is the trend. It has happened more and more.
Because it was a month ago that the deadliest mass shooting in the country.
That 56 people died in Las Vegas.
Barely a month later, this happens. Like, it's getting more frequent. But here's the thing. Sandy Hook was not enough to change people's opinions. In fact, what we learned was it just hardened people on both sides. And people thought, if not the slaughter of six-year-olds, and I have to admit, this is one of those things where I have never been able to read the profiles of the kids who were killed. I could not look at the pictures because, you know, I have a second grader and I have a three-year-old, and it's too close. I can't. It drives me over a wall enough that they have to shelter in place and do those drills at school. You know, because there are things that we can't control. We do tornado drills. Well, you know, you can't control a tornado. This is because of our sickness that this takes place. But Sandy Hook didn't change it. Las Vegas didn't change it. This is not going to change anything. Even if we had one of these every day, I don't think it would change anything. And what I have been grappling with is this is, at the end of the day, it's a secular culture. Gun culture is secular. If this was a sexualized culture that had pervaded the church would rise up to get rid of it. Because what I was taught growing up, and what I know you have heard as well, is that it's us against the world. We are in the world, but not of the world. And it is our job to challenge the culture, except when it comes to gun culture. And then that has somehow become inflated with our identities as Christians. And I know a lot of that has overlap with regional culture because, you know, white evangelicalism is strongest in the South. And, you know, you've got a strong gun owning tradition in the South, not just because of hunting, but, you know, there's a whole history going back towards kind of male aggression and the need to protect your land, basically, you know, referred to as honor culture, but also just a real protecting your economic investment. But that's not the reality of most of our lives anymore. And yet, I think there must be pastors who are terrified to bring this up. And then there are pastors who aid and abet this joining of gun culture and evangelicalism. This is where we might want to get into the armor of light, because it tells the story of a very conservative evangelical, Reverend Rob Schenck, who actually I had come across in the 1990s when I was working on the Hill on abortion legislation. And he was known most for being a leading anti-abortion activist and getting arrested for blockading clinics. And he had a real epiphany a few years ago, centered around the attack in Southeast Washington at one of the government buildings. And my mind is blocking what it is now. But he had this real sense of, whoa, I've been calling myself pro-life and yet doing nothing about the gun issue. And that can't continue. And he kind of joined forces with the mother of the boy who was killed, Jordan, in Florida. He was the kid who was in a car with his friends, and the dude thought their music was too loud and started firing it into their car and killed him. And so the movie kind of follows Rob as he decides he really has a responsibility to take this to his fellow evangelicals and his fellow pro-life activists and advocates. And, you know, it's not a happy golden ending because he runs into precisely this kind of pushback, you know, the idea that there is, you know, a biblical justification for arming yourself in your home.
Yes. And it is, it's one of those things that I think about that I wonder how the conversation amongst evangelicals would change if perhaps evangelicals approached the gun control debate not first as a gun owner, but as a believer in Christ first. Because I think that's one of the things that we're seeing happen, is that people are approaching this conversation first as gun owners, second as Christians. And you and I have talked about this, is there seems to be some sort of almost like a retrofitting as a, you know, evangelicals are allowing their theology and understanding of this issue to be shaped by the issue itself and by their status as a gun owner. And so I wonder how, if we were to totally like dismantle and tear down the argument, and start from brass tacks, right? And start from the very bottom level and say, okay, let's approach this from a deeply theological issue, or, you know, from a very theological perspective. let's approach it from the lens through which we are supposed to view and understand everything in the world first. And that is through the lenses, you know, being the beloved, being, you know, a member of the body of Christ, being citizens of the kingdom of God. If we could reevaluate and reimagine this debate coming from that perspective first, and then allowing that to inform our understanding of guns and what it's doing to the world that we're supposed to be in and that we're supposed to, you know, affect change in for the better, how then would this be reframed? How then would we be able to move the needle? And I don't think it's going to happen on any sort of like national level. I don't think it's going to be like, you know, one magical pastor with a giant platform all of a sudden says the magical words that are going to change everyone's mind on this issue. That's not what's going to happen. But churches can, individual communities, local communities. I would really encourage, if there's any pastors out there that are listening that have not watched Armor of Light, the documentary, I would really please, please, please watch it.
Watch it and screen it for your church.
Yes, it is super important. And I know that we get a little riled up about this stuff and say, but I don't want to get political. I don't want my church to be political. We have all of those sorts of fears, but we're past the point now where like we have to start addressing this.
Well, and there are resources. I want to also point folks to the website, GodAndGuns2016.com. There was a 2-day workshop hosted by Riverside Church in New York. And it was about how faith leaders can address gun violence. And it was working through how to overcome ambivalence or even opposition within your congregation to get people to have respectful but tough discussions about it. You're not doing this alone, but it's going to take everybody being willing to get past the discomfort and, you know, lives are at stake. It's important.
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak for anyone else, but I know for me, I don't want my children to grow up in this environment where they have to prepare and have drills for a mass shooting in their schools. Like, I feel like we have hit a very critical juncture where we are now preparing our children for these sorts of moments. And I don't want that for my kids. And I know tons of conservative, evangelical, Second Amendment loving people that don't want that for their kids either. And so in what way can, like, what are some of the small steps that we can start taking to reframe the conversation and actually come around this and see it as a pro-life communal flourishing issue? And it has to start with local communities and people honestly having a willingness and being truly heartbroken enough. Like you have to be willing to look at the situation and say, enough, I don't want this anymore. I can't be complicit in this anymore. And I think that enough people actually are there. I think a lot of people are looking at this and going, this, something's not right. This isn't right. And there is, I think, underlying somewhere a will to change, but it's actually going to cost us something. It's going to cost us convenience. It's going to cost us our comfort. It's going to ask really hard questions about like constitutional rights in the Second Amendment, but it's worth it. Like a one life saved in these mass shootings to me is worth it. And we have to determine that it's worth it as a community.
So as it happens, we have a frame that is very familiar to folks in white evangelical communities. And this observation is going to make people on all sides mad, but that's what I do best. Which is that in many ways, the folks who are so adamantly opposed to gun restrictions or stricter laws, let's say, are fetishizing individual choice in a way that they abhor when the issue is abortion. And I think that folks who are on the far left of pro-abortion rights also might have something to learn from the way that they talk about supporting gun restrictions, that it can be about more than just you. And, you know, this is a way of speaking and thinking about an issue that, as I said, evangelicals are very familiar with, and yet it's kind of thrown out the window when we talk about guns. And maybe that can be one way to approach it. I mean, I don't hold out hope that we have terribly healthy ways of talking about abortion issues and rights issues in churches right now either. But it is a little bit of cognitive dissonance that always strikes me on this, that is worth people kind of doing some self-examination about and thinking, well, if I believe that more matters than just me and what I want and my choices, then why is it so different when it comes to guns? Why am I so afraid? And maybe even if what matters to us is supposed to be the next life, why am I willing to do anything, even take another life, to protect my physical life here? Which is not to say we shouldn't embrace and love and enjoy our lives and try to bring about long lives for everybody. But as Christians, we are taught that this is not all that there is. And that seems to be forgotten when we engage this debate.
Yep. And that's the question, right? Does every life really matter here and now?
Or just mine?
Yeah. And to what lengths are we willing to go to protect it? And to what lengths are we willing to go to actually love our neighbors and see those neighbors flourish in their own lives? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an impossibly complicated issue with a lot of different things to consider. And yet it seems to me like if we don't start having this conversation now and start dissecting and peeling back and dismantling and rebuilding some of this conversation now, if we haven't already, we're going to hit a point of no return. And
yeah, we've already lost our ever-loving minds.
Yeah, I mean,
this is just about, you know, trying to get some of it back while we still can.
Right. Let's be very clear. America is batshit crazy right now. But
we almost got through an episode without Nish swearing. Almost.
And about guns. I went 45 minutes almost without saying a single swear word, and we were talking about guns. I feel like I deserve a trophy.
I think this is a good breaking point. We are almost out of time for this week. Now, usually at the end of a show, we leave you with a few pop culture recommendations. But that just does not seem quite right today. Not because we shouldn't give ourselves the space that we need to breathe and to focus on something else and take care of ourselves, and I hope you all are doing that. But because there may be other things that are harder to come by this week, like words of solace and words of hope.
Yeah. After each mass shooting, we hear a lot about thoughts and prayers. So much, in fact, that the phrase itself is now the subject of a lot of heated arguments and debates. And so, but as Christians, we believe in the power of prayer, but we also believe that God calls us to action. And so, Amy, I don't know about you, but I really appreciated the prayer that former President Barack Obama offered on Twitter on Sunday night. In addition to prayers for the victims and their families, he wrote, "May God also grant us all of the wisdom to ask what concrete steps we can take to reduce the violence and weaponry in our midst."
So our friend Kate Bowler, who is a brilliant professor at Duke Divinity School and also one of the loveliest people we know.
We love you, Kate.
Also, yeah, hang in there, Kate. She reminded us this week of a blessing written by pastor and artist Jan Richardson. It's called "A Blessing When the World is Ending." And I wanted to share just a bit of it. We'll post the full text on our show website. "This blessing will not fix you, will not mend you, will not give you false comfort. It will not talk to you about one door opening when another one closes. It will simply sit itself beside you among the shards and gently turn your face toward the direction from which the light will come, gathering itself about you as the world begins again.
Amen. Well, that's all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us, guys, and suffering through a really difficult conversation. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation and thought it was valuable, please subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or the Google Play Store, on Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback, and we'll post links to our show notes there as well. And until next week, take care of each other.